Welcome to episode 6 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I am film watcher Greg Ralph.
Wow, Greg, this is actually
I know.
Our first recording together.
In almost a year. Since we recorded last Christmas.
That's right.
So for those who are regular listeners, you would know that we live in Melbourne, Australia. And Melbourne has only just come out of COVID-related lockdown for the last 8 months. And
that's
so
right.
We have recorded episodes socially distanced, appropriately.
Every episode you would have heard before this episode for this season was done in lockdown.
Which meant that we were at our own homes, connected by FaceTime over our little mobiles. Cell phones. for the uninitiated. And with headphones on, talking into recording devices, and Ricardo has gone above and beyond in actually knitting that all together some fashion. So to be cheek by jowl once more after a year is... Well, it's special for us. I don't know about you guys.
It probably just sounds exactly the same for you guys. So this episode, Greg, tell us about what we're doing on this episode here.
Well, the last one we did was we felt like we really wanted some films that would make us laugh because we'd been in lockdown and things were all a bit heavy. And with variable success in terms of the films we actually chose. And when I say variable... What worked for you didn't work for me.
That's right.
And vice versa.
Yes.
But this one and our next one in the season will be where we take films that one of us has seen and the other hasn't. Mm. So this time around, we've called it Ricardo in the Confessional. And we've chosen three films that I have seen but Ricardo hasn't. And it's about time that he did, quite frankly. Although we've chosen one of these films to be something where he's read the book. Even he hasn't seen the film, and
we'll come to that
in a moment. And next time we're going to flip that, and we're going to do three films that I haven't seen and probably should, where Ricardo has seen all three, but I, in fact, have read the book for one. Admittedly, at school a long time ago, but, you know, it still holds true.
Yeah.
So this time around, do you want to say the films that we're watching?
Yeah, so the first film we're going to be discussing is the 1999 film Galaxy Quest.
And then the film where Ricardo has actually read the book, the Stephen King story, Dolores Claiborne, we're doing the 1995 film from that story.
And then we're going to discuss the 1957 film, 12 Angry Men.
With a special shout out to our friend Michael, for whom this is a favourite film.
And yeah,
we thought
right.
It's about time we kept Michael happy.
Yeah, absolutely. This is for you, Michael. So, Greg, why don't you just take us back to 1999 with Galaxy Quest.
Alan Rickman in a film with Tim Allen and Sigourney Weaver. What film could that possibly be? Well, it is 1999's Galaxy Quest, a comedy which affectionately skewers the Star Trek genre while somehow simultaneously delivering a love letter to the show and its fan base. In fact, it's the geeky fans who provide the solution that defeats the bad guy. First-time screenwriter David Howard had the original idea when he saw that Leonard Nimoy, Star Trek's Mr. Spock, was narrating a space documentary. Howard wondered about the post-Star Trek career of pigeonholed actors and what would happen if they encountered real aliens. DreamWorks saw the script's possibilities and commissioned a significant rewrite by Star Trek fan Bob Gordon, who was initially reluctant to take it on, but focused on bringing out the comedy. So the Galaxy Quest TV show was cancelled 15 years ago. The actors now make a living appearing at fan conventions and store openings. Their careers are going nowhere. Shakespearean actor Alexander Dane, the Mr. Spock character played by Alan Rickman, is particularly dispirited at the meaninglessness of his work. The Galaxy Quest's captain, Jason Nesmith, played by Tim Allen, is clearly based on William Shatner as Captain Kirk, content to coast on his pop culture fame for the money and lifestyle. He's approached by the Thermians, led by Enrico Colantoni, Patrick Breen, Jed Reese, and Missy Pyle, an octopus-like race of scientists who came across the old Galaxy Quest episodes, not realising that it's fictional, and redeveloped their technology and culture to align with these historical documents. The Thermians are now confronted by bully boy grasshopper alien Saris, Robin Sachs, who is demanding their secret weapon, Omega 13, even though no one, including Saris, knows what it actually does. The Thermians come to Earth to recruit their hero, Commander Peter Quincy Taggart, to negotiate their way out of trouble. The actor accepts their invitation, thinking it's just another paid promotional gig from his cosplay groupies. But he lands the Thermians in even more trouble because he doesn't realise the true situation until it's too late. And then later returns with his similarly disbelieving crew as they try to rescue the adorably innocent Thermians. If you're remotely a Trekkie, you're going to love this film. It just nails all the elements. From the trumpet-filled opening theme through its classic Star Trek-style plot and emotional payoffs. And like The Princess Bride, if you love this film, you'll really love it. But you don't have to be a Trekkie. I've seen Galaxy Quest 3 or 4 times now. When I first saw it at the movies, the audience built to a state of total hilarity, including my wife, not a fan of the genre, that I had dragged along. Then, at the crest of the film, the projector broke and the manager had to come out to apologise while we waited 5 to 10 minutes for its repair. And I thought, well, there goes the hilarity. But amazingly, when the film restarted, the audience was immediately back in the groove. And that's when I knew this was a great comedy. I approached rewatching Galaxy Quest this time with a little trepidation, fearing it may have dated. But the writing and the performances are top-notch. Alan Rickman is fantastic from the get-go, expressing so much with his eyes, voice, and a curl of his lip. He was keen to do the film because it was so funny, but was also influential in ensuring that script revisions also nailed the drama. As I said in our Christmas 2018 episode when we reviewed The Santa Claus, I'm not the biggest Tim Allen fan, but he's terrific doing William Shatner as both the actor and his Captain Kirk persona. TV's OCD detective monk, Tony Shalhoub, is so chilled in the engineer role as a constantly snacking actor who calmly accepts everything going on around him. Sam Rockwell plays paranoid crewman 6 for laughs as a nod to the anonymous red shirt crewman who died when Star Trek teams beamed down to a planet. Enrico Colantoni is terrific as Thermian leader Mathazar, bringing innocence and pathos to the role. He was cast after using an actor's vocal exercise in his audition to devise the Thermian speech patterns. Justin Long plays Brandon, the lead Galaxy Quest fan who saves the world while having to put out the garbage. And Sigourney Weaver is inspired casting as the blonde communications officer who has one job to do to repeat what the computer just said. All the characters had their redemptive arc and parts of the film are genuinely moving. Despite having fun with the genre, it ultimately respects and celebrates how storytelling and the show's values can genuinely inspire people and alien octopi. The Trekkie fan base has voted this the 7th best Star Trek film of all time. Nicholas Meyer, director of fan favourite The Wrath of Khan, has called it the best of the Star Trek movies. An acclaimed writer-director David Mamet included it in his list of 4 perfect films, along with The Godfather, A Place in the Sun, and Dodsworth. Yes, I know, I expected you to look like that, Ricardo. So, Ricardo, I think I know the answer to my question. Trekkie or not, are you with Mamet, Meyer, and the fans, or...?
I'm not with Mamet, come on. The Godfather, I mean, can't you... I mean, no. I didn't mind Galaxy Quest. I'm not a Trekkie as such. I've seen a bit of Star Trek. I watched a little bit of some of the movies, the Star Trek movies. I've never watched the series, but the movie Star Trek, some of the older movies, and they were fine. I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it either. It was kind of just enjoyable in parts. But one thing it surprised me is that Mathazar was very good.
Yep.
He was very good in that role because actually when at the very end, I won't say what happens, but you actually feel genuinely for that character. Because that race of people is, you know, that's all there is left of them. And I must say, I actually loved those guys, the aliens. What are they from?
Thermians.
The Thermians. I actually loved the Thermians. The actress who plays the female there,
Missy Pyle.
Yes, she's great. She's very good. And when her and Fred Kwan, the monk guy,
the
engineer, get together and they kiss. And
Sam Rockwell is standing there saying, oh, you guys, that's just not right.
There's all this alien stuff going on. And it's
tentacles coming
out. Yeah, that's right. And he's sitting there going, oh, yeah. And then Sam Rockwell's going, no, this is not right. That was very funny. Alan Rickman's great, but he's always great, and he plays Alan Rickman.
But that's part of the joke.
It is. It is.
But you know, for me, the most moving scene in the whole film is when he's cradling one of the dying aliens in his arms.
Mm.
So his character has that tagline of, you know, by Grabthar's hammer, I will avenge thee.
Yes, and he doesn't like it when people usually say it.
Yeah, and whenever he says it in such a completely disengaged voice, you know, oh, I have to say this line now, and here it is, blah, blah, blah. And when they go to these, you know, fan conventions and everyone's ecstatic about his character and he just doesn't care and he just feels like his life is on the wrong path. And then he meets this completely idealistic alien who has completely bought, as the whole race have, has completely bought into the whole ethos of the show and actually believes this line that he just spouts.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Rickman's character finds himself saying it as comfort to the dying alien, and suddenly those words are invested with real meaning. And you can see on his face, because he's such a superb actor.
He is.
You can see that he suddenly realised that these words, and in fact the whole thing, and I said, you know, the power of storytelling, actually can be invested with such meaning, and that's where its value is. And suddenly he reevaluates not only his life, but all those kind of geeks he sees at the conventions, because they've bought into it in the same way. It actually has real meaning for them.
Yeah, I did pick that they were going to do that. I knew that him disliking it so much that at the very end he was going to say it with meaning.
That's fine.
It just came up. But it was genuinely moving, that section. But I thought it was going to be funnier. I really did. I don't mind Tim Allen. I find he's just, you know, he's a hit or miss. I can take or leave.
He works for that part.
He does.
Same way that he works for Buzz Lightyear.
Mm. Yes, it's his best role.
They're both characters where they are not terribly deep, braggarty kind of characters. Mm.
After I watched it, I was sort of like, oh, yeah, I was done. I've watched Galaxy Quest. There was nothing that amazing about it. That I thought it was going to be better. I thought I was going to actually find myself laughing a lot more. Maybe I didn't get the references. Maybe I didn't get those Star Trek references.
I think there were probably two reasons why it didn't work for you. And one of those is that you're not a Trekkie. Now, coincidentally, we've talked about Star Wars this season, and I've watched the Star Wars things. They don't do much for me. You know, I see them because they're kind of on and, you know, they're fairly central now. But I am a Trekkie. I'm even more, as you know, I think, a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
But what I like about both those shows over Star Wars, I think, is that there is actually interesting concepts in these shows that are not just adventure stories, although they certainly are that, but they raise interesting questions. So one of the best Star Trek episodes I've ever seen from a much later series was about the fact that two of the regular characters had beamed up from a planet and because of this set of circumstances had merged into a third new character. And the whole story was about, did they have the right to take apart this being in its own right to get their friends back? They raise interesting questions. And so that's why I like Star Trek. There's a lot of fun about Star Trek as well. So if you know Star Trek, even to a bit, the jokes about, you know, the crewman who dies when he gets to the planet, you know, what they call the red shirt.
Straight over my
head. Yeah, I know. And the jokes about, you know, why is this machine even in here that we have to get through to, you know, press the big button? They're funnier if you know the show and the tropes of that show.
I'm sure it would be.
But the second thing that you missed out on, that my wife had in spades, even though she'd never seen the show and it's not her kind of show, saw it in a Full House.
Yeah, right.
So Patrick Stewart, who played the head of the Enterprise, Picard, in the next series, didn't want to go and see the film when it came out. And Jonathan Frakes, who played his number two, said to him, no, you've got to go, but you have to go to a Full House on a Saturday night. And Stuart went and he loved it.
Mm.
If you go to see this film with an audience where, as I said, you know, in my first experience...
Yeah, you're going to get that interaction.
You'll ride it much more. Yeah. But then it stands up to repeated viewings for me, partly because I have that memory.
Yeah.
Largely because I actually do think you're certainly helped by knowing all the tropes and so on. But I think the way the story runs and the characters and the casting of Sigourney Weaver...
Oh, she was great.
Who apparently she loved doing
this
part. In
fact, everybody's good in this.
Yes, I know.
It's not. And the thing is, you know, it's not that I didn't...
Saris is good.
Yeah, very good. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. I actually did enjoy it. I enjoyed my time watching it. I just thought if I was more of a Trekkie, I knew I was missing references. I knew it.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it was a bit frustrating, because I knew that it was, I know that it's funny. A lot of people I've spoken to find it really funny, and they're a bit like you, that it's, oh, Galaxy Quest, oh, it's so good, it's so good, you got to see this. It was a little bit frustrating for me, because I was thinking, this should be funnier than what I'm finding it.
I suspect that the idea from this film actually comes from an episode of the original Star Trek.
Right.
There was an episode they made back in 68 where a century prior, a crew from an Enterprise kind of vessel had left a book on this nascent culture, and they left behind a novel about 1920s Chicago gangsters. And when the heroes of the story come back, they find that this planet now has become a recreation of Chicago in the 20s, and they have to work out what should they do about this, given that they're actually, you know, to blame. And I think that's where the idea for this film came too. There were great jokes there that didn't rely on Star Trek.
Mm.
And one of my favourite lines is that when the actors realise that the Thermians think that these TV shows, because they have no concept of storytelling,
that's right. Yep.
were actually historic documents. And they say to them, so did you see Gilligan's Island?
Yes.
And all the Thermians look up and go, oh, those poor people.
Yeah.
Did you laugh at that?
I did.
There's stuff all the way through.
Yeah, I chuckled at that. I didn't.
Yeah,
well, I wasn't bursting
out laughing. No, but it's a great line.
Yeah, it is. It is. Oh, and the other bit with the baby aliens. I really love that scene.
Oh, the little blue ones on the planet.
Little blue and the planet. And there's that one which has a broken leg. And starts going towards
the
weapon.
They're
going
to look after them. It's so cute.
Sigourney Weaver's going, oh, look at her. And then suddenly they start pulling it apart.
Well, this film was originally meant to be directed by Harold Ramis.
Oh, right.
And he didn't want Tim Allen, and he didn't want Sigourney Weaver, even though he knew her obviously from Ghostbusters, because he didn't want people in the film who had a sci-fi background, like she had in Aliens.
Like okay.
And she thought he was wrong. She thought he was wrong because she said people who do sci-fi know why it's funny, you know, where the kind of the holes are.
That's right.
And after he left the project, she lobbied and auditioned and so on. She got the part. But she loved that whole persona because it was so different to what she normally is. So the blonde wig, the fact that they pushed her cleavage up and gave her that tight outfit.
Oh, and then it comes undone by the end of it. So you're just looking at a bra and cleavage.
Well, I'll come back to that too. But she reveled in that persona. She said that character who's insecure about what they're doing is actually much closer to me than Ripley is.
Wow. Yeah.
And she would go home after the shooting in the outfit and the blonde wig just to keep staying in that kind of mode. She just loved it so much. And who knows where she went on those evenings. But the other thing about this film is that there are deleted scenes. And the scenes were deleted at the behest of DreamWorks, the studio, because they wanted to keep, I think it was a PG rating, a family movie.
Yeah.
So they cut some things out. And you can see some of these deleted scenes that are great scenes. So when she and the captain are down at the big button and about to push it, then these alien guys come up, you know, they're kind of the crab, grasshopper kind of creatures, and they're going to shoot them and expel them into space or something. And but one of them says, but the blonde one, she's quite hot. And she starts playing up to that. And she starts, undoing the cleavage even more, which is why it's undone later
on from
this removed scene.
Oh, right.
And
I was wondering when that came. I thought it just happened. And I thought it's just. The thing is, one thing, this film can't really date that much because.
I thought it might have done, as I said, but yeah.
But I don't think it can, really, even if the effects and everything start getting poor, because it's made like that. Like it's an old school.
But they actually take the effects very seriously. Like they're high end.
Oh, they are high end.
But I want to finish telling you about the Sigourney Weaver story.
Okay, keep going.
So in this deleted scene, Tim Allen's character saying, what are you doing? We've got to press the button, you know. And she says, I just need a moment, you know. And then she says to his guards, you know, she's taking the zip down, you know, I think we need a bit more privacy. So she says to the computer, you know, lower door 25B, and this door comes down and squashes these two bug-like aliens. Like that, that's a great scene, but probably much of a PG. And Alan Rickman's character, they had scenes certainly written and I think filmed for each of the characters to see the living quarters that have been imagined for them from the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Rickman's character goes into a bedroom where there is nothing. It's completely, you know, austere and sterile and meditative. And then they open the door to his toilet that they had to imagine because it was never actually shown on the show, where you've got all these weird, like, suction devices and sharp, pointy things.
Oh, wow.
And he's just looking at, you know, just thinking, oh, my God, what do I do? So there's actually, I think, an even funnier film that never quite got made because they were really focused on capturing that family audience. Mm-hmm. So I don't even want to try and guess. What are you going to give this film?
I'm giving it a 6 out of 10. It was great. It was fine. It was just an enjoyable film. I didn't really think it was that amazing, or it wasn't a bad film either. It just sort of washed over me, really.
Well, at this stage, lockdown's looking pretty good. I'm giving it an 8.
Oh, okay.
I think it.
Well, I thought you might, considering you've.
I actually teetered towards a 9.
Oh, wow.
Because yeah. I do think I'm not actually sure why David Mamet says what he says, and to put it on that list of top
ridiculous.
Four perfect little films, that to me is a bit of a stretch. But yeah. It's so well constructed, and the way it brings in the fans at the end too is a really nice payoff for the fan base.
Mm.
I think this is probably one of the first films ever, certainly big feature films, that really recognise those fans were out there and the love.
And I see that. Yeah. I see that. Like I said, I think the references, I think I missed a lot. So I'm sure that if I was a Trekkie, I would have got a lot more and probably given it an 8 or a 9, you know. But yeah, as a film, just me watching it without knowing that, you know, I felt like it was a fan film.
Well, next time the Trekkie convention is in town, and if they're showing Galaxy Quest in a theatre, I'm taking you.
Okay, perfect.
So, Ricardo, for our second film that you had not seen previously, but in this case had read the book, tell us about 1995's Dolores Claiborne.
Based on the Stephen King book and directed by Taylor Hackford, who directed films such as Proof of Life and Ray, this 1995 film centres itself around the film's title character, Dolores Claiborne, Kathy Bates, who has been accused of murdering wealthy old grouch Vera Donovan, who she has worked and cared for as a housemaid for many years. The film opens on an argument between the two, with shadows above the staircase showing their confrontation, with Vera suddenly looking to be pushed down the stairs. It shows Dolores holding a heavy stone rolling pin above her head, ready to land the final death blow, until she is spotted by the mailman, who stops her. Vera's fall ultimately killed her. As she is being investigated by Detective John McKay, Christopher Plummer, her estranged daughter, Selena, Jennifer Jason Leigh, a successful reporter, visits her for support. Selena blames her mother for the death of her abusive father, David Strathairn, thus believes that Dolores could have actually killed Vera. This is more a psychological drama with thriller elements than straight-up thriller, as a lot is revealed about their family's domestic strife. This is quite cleverly portrayed in flashbacks, which present themselves in vivid colour, contrasting the present, which is coloured in gloomy, cool blue tones. Now, I read this book as a teenager and loved it. I always thought it would be hard to put to film, however, because the novel is told by Dolores in the first-person perspective. Also, daughter Selena only appears as a kid.
Oh.
The book concentrates more on Dolores' relationship with Vera and the abusive relationship with her husband, whereas the movie tends to focus more on the mother-daughter relationship with a grown-up Selena. I think screenwriter Tony Gilroy adapted this story really well, however, considering how the book is written. Now, I don't want to give too much away here, but there's a lot to like. The performances, especially from the ever-dependable Kathy Bates, are all first class. I also love the subtle direction by Hackford. He services this character-driven narrative by never letting the camera do too much, allowing the actors just to tell the story. I really like this. Greg, what did you think?
That's a really interesting shift from the novel to the film.
Oh, it's a big shift.
It is. And, you know, sometimes when scriptwriters do that to a story, they get it right.
Mm.
And sometimes they just muck it up and take away what made it successful in the first place. But that is a really interesting and, I think, successful shift, not having read the story.
Yes.
Is it a short story or a novel?
It's a novel.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. And I certainly agree about the use of colours. And
beautifully
we could
done.
Talk about the eclipse scene with the brilliant reds.
Yes.
And I think the flashbacks are handled brilliantly. There's one in particular,
yeah.
One of the early ones where you're in the same room looking at the same hall and it suddenly shifts from the decayed house of now to the family home of before. But you haven't mentioned one of my absolute favourite elements in the film. And I saw this film probably in the late 90s. And I always remembered the eclipse scene and the lighting of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remembered the performance of Judy Parfitt as Vera Donovan.
Oh, she's very good, actually.
I think she's superb.
Yeah, she is, actually. I didn't mention her.
In the different time periods, that early on she's this, you know, society matron of steel. Very clear, strong blue eyes and the flaming red hair, probably out of a bottle, you suspect, but very vivid character. And who turns out to have quite strong ideas about what, you know, is acceptable and not acceptable for men in your world. And then in the latter part of the story, which is where the film actually starts, she's this frail woman who survived a stroke, not terribly well. The eyes have dimmed. I don't know how you do that, but the maybe contact lenses, but the eyes have dimmed. I think at that stage she's got the grey hair. And she's this frail, still a strong spirit buried inside there, but the body has absolutely betrayed her. I have seen Judy Parfitt originally many years ago in The Jewel and the Crown.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen her on stage in London in An Inspector Calls, where she was masterful. She's currently playing the dotty old nun in Call the Midwife on TV. And anything I see her in, I love. I think she is just a great actress. And these two parts, I keep using this word, but I think it's a masterclass in acting. She is so, so good.
Yeah, and yes, she
is. And she wouldn't be for me in a way that Christopher Plummer and Jennifer Jason Leigh and Kathy Bates would be familiar to an American audience and others. She would be an unknown. For me, she's actually one of the highlights of the film.
It's interesting with the eclipse sequence because in the book, she has a vision of a woman in bed, chained to the bed.
Oh, yes.
And that is the image. She sees the woman in Gerard's Game, which is... It's like the other Stephen King book, which came out not long after, and now there's a movie on Netflix called Gerard's Game, but that is what she has a vision of that, and in Gerard's Game, she has a vision on the bed of Dolores Claiborne over a well, and it's really interesting. I love those little.
Well, I think they actually do it in this movie because at one stage, Kathy Bates, only 5 years after making Stephen King's Misery, is standing over David Strathairn with an axe. And I thought, this feels like a bit of an echo.
Yeah.
Kathy Bates said this is probably her favourite character she's created. She really enjoyed this.
Okay. She did it beautifully, and I loved her portrayal of Dolores. The book, the character's a lot harsher than the way Kathy Bates portrayed her.
She's a fairly harsh character.
Yeah, no, but even worse, like in language. And it's almost like it's told from Dolores at about 80, you know, telling this story about what happened when she was, you know, in her life.
Mm.
So it's actually told from more of an older woman, really grouchy old woman sort of thing, more of a Vera. The language is really quite crass in the way she talks as well. What I loved about Kathy Bates in this is she brought a real soft side to that character, which I thought was lacking in the novel.
You need sympathy for her as the central character.
Yeah, you do.
Otherwise, the story doesn't work both in terms of Vera Donovan, who was her employer, or the daughter. She has to have that soft side. I'm not the biggest fan of Jennifer Jason Leigh. I usually find her quite cold. I did like her where I thought she was basically doing Katharine Hepburn in The Hudsucker Proxy, which I don't think you've seen.
No.
But this is another film that I like her in. I think she's right for the part.
I really like her in this.
She's that bitter, alienated character who eventually thaws in a certain kind of way.
Look, that was all new to me, this that sort of part of the story, and it was obviously written for the film. There was a lot of layers to her performance and her role because of what happened to her in her life and the questioning she was talking about. I mean, she was growing up thinking that her mum killed her father and, you know, the fact that she's going back there thinking that she's committed a crime against Vera. And so she's got her own baggage there. So she's she's an alcoholic, you know, takes pills. But she's a successful writer.
I don't know how successful she actually is. When you introduce this film, I mean, there's a sense that her career's on the rocks. Like she's been involved with her editor and that's fallen apart.
In that one section.
That she's actually the sense you get is she's actually a very good writer, but her personal problems have gotten in the way. And as a result, she's on a downward path.
Mm.
And in fact, this return home to work out her past, you can see that potentially that puts her on a better path.
Oh, absolutely. Completely. But, I mean,
The structure of the story...
Healing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the structure of the story is interesting because when you start the film, you think the central mystery is what happened to Vera Donovan.
Mm.
Did Dolores actually kill Vera, or is there something else going on? And you have a sense there is, but you don't really know what's happening.
Yeah.
And then that mystery is actually resolved about halfway through.
And that's most of the book.
Yeah.
They got rid of that pretty quickly. And in the book, you're going, oh, did it happen? Did it happen? Did it happen?
And then this other central question arises that has been slowly bubbling away, which in 1995 would have been quite shocking, I think. I think we're now sufficiently jaded, unfortunately,
yeah,
that it's less of a kind of a revelation, if you like. You can see it coming, I think, now.
Mm.
But you do get to see that story. And apart from Judy Parfitt's performance, as I say, for me, what makes this film is that flashback to the day of the eclipse and what really happens to the father.
Oh, yes. It's a great sequence.
And visually,
you can almost sense that it was shot on a soundstage, which it probably has.
Well, it was. I watched an extra on the DVD this time around, which I think you would have been in a better place to understand because my brain just doesn't do the technical stuff very well.
Yeah.
But they filmed it in four layers. So it was filmed on a soundstage, but the background, they're on this kind of little hill overlooking the wealthy yacht club bay that you see. I think there's a lighthouse as well, but you see all that kind of background perfectly in place around the scene. Then they did something with red lights to really give that very intense look. It's quite a striking sequence visually.
Yeah, it is.
And it makes the film, I think.
I thought they did really well with the makeup and the hair, because those flashbacks when they're a lot younger, they really look younger.
They do.
You know, and that's not de-aging technologies or whatnot.
Not like now.
Not in 1995.
No, you tell the young kids that now. we used to have to do it for real.
That's right. And so they did a really good job with that, and because she really looks weathered in, and like she's really had life wear her down in those later scenes. But beautiful colouring of the film there, and those sort of blue tones and the vivid sort of colour in those other sections. Oh, look, it's an emotional ride as well. I really loved this film. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good adaptation when they added so much more to it. So, really, really striking.
Well, we should mention some of the men in this film as well. So David Strathairn is very good in the part. Because he's usually playing a much more urbane kind of character.
Mm, yes.
And this is a real kind of redneck character.
Oh, yeah. And when I noticed it was him, I mean, it was only 95, so he's looking a lot older now, and he looks quite young in that. So I just took him back and went, oh, my God, it's David Strathairn. He's very good. But everybody.
Christopher Plummer is solid in his part.
Yeah, he's strong. But John C. Reilly, a young John C. Reilly in there. Yes.
Is that his first feature film? It must be up there.
I don't think it was. But it's before Boogie Nights, obviously. That was
2 years before that, in 97, yeah.
But he did Hard Eight as well, I think, in 96 or 97. But I think it was definitely early on. But again, he's always serviceable. I like John C. Reilly a lot. I'm amazed that Stephen King didn't make a cameo in this either.
As what?
He usually does his cameos in movies. But I'm a Stephen King fan. I read a lot of Stephen King when I was younger.
Oh, so is this now time for the revenge of the Trekkie? Stephen King.
So you didn't really get it, did you? You don't really understand Stephen King, though.
No, I'm a nice boy.
Yeah.
I live for the optimism of future frontiers in space, not dark. Depressing.
It's not
horrific.
Dark. No, you don't know Stephen. He's a dark, depressing. No, I'll tell you a funny story though.
Yeah.
One day I was looking for a Stephen King novel and I wanted to go into a bookshop and I started walking out. I grew up in Lilydale, Victoria. And
that's regional Melbourne for those elsewhere.
And I went into a bookstore, not knowing which bookstore I was going into. And I said, hi, how are you going? I was looking around the shop for a while and I was like, oh, goodness, I couldn't really find what I was looking for. And I said to the lady, I said, oh, do you have any Stephen King? And she said, oh, this old, lovely old lady said, oh, no, we don't have Stephen King. And I went, oh, okay. Oh, so, oh, damn, okay. And then she goes, but we have a Chris King and he's very, very good. And it was, I think the book was called something like The Lord Saveth Thee or something. And it sort of dawned on me that I was in the Catholic bookshop. And I'm asking for the horror section of Stephen King.
There's probably a good book there called The Mark of the Beast or something.
Something like that, yeah. But it was, look, I I was a big Stephen King fan growing up. I read most of the novels of Stephen King, but this was a really short story, and I really enjoyed this for that. I mean, he usually writes quite long stories and can get quite waffly in there. Like the Tommyknockers is great in book one and book three. In there, book two, Tales of Haven, is like it gets a little bit waffly about the characters, and it's good setting stuff. But sometimes you can sort of wander off a little bit to come back to what the thrilling parts are. The Dark Half was one of my favourites, where an author's pseudonym starts coming back to haunt him.
So you don't think things like Salem's Lot, Pet Sematary, It are dark and depressing?
Oh, they are. Well, they're dark horrors.
Yeah, they are. That's what I mean.
But they are dark horrors, but they're very good. They're very well done. Jeez, he's very good.
It's not my genre. I don't want to go there by and large.
Mm.
But this film is not like that.
No, it's not like that at all. It's actually more of a human drama and with thrilling. Like I said, it's a psychological drama.
And it peels away the layers of the story to get to what actually happened all those years ago. Mm. As well as, you think the story is about what happened a week or two ago.
Yes.
And the story is actually about what happened 20-something years ago.
The book has the abuse of the father goes on for a few years, so it's not like a couple of months like the movie seems to sort of allude to.
Well, there's another powerful scene we haven't yet mentioned, which is when the daughter is leaving town as an adult on the ferry and has a flashback to a moment on the ferry with her father and realises what it was all about.
Yeah, I was going to leave that the scene, but I...
Well, I haven't said what happens. Yes, just that moment of revelation, I think that works really well.
It does, and it's very well handled too.
Yeah, it could have been sensationalist or more, shall we say, controversial.
Yes.
So what are you giving this film?
I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. I think it's beautifully made. I think it's a really well-made movie and a really good adaptation. So I strongly recommend anybody, don't be put off by seeing Stephen King's name to it. I think you'll enjoy it. I know that, my partner Ninian would just go, oh, Dolores Claiborne, Stephen King, and sort of she's not a fan of horror. But
my wife and we've watched this and enjoyed it.
Yeah. I think it's craft in this film and the performances and the filmmaking and the subtlety of it and the way the story does progress is a lot better than films that are made at the moment. It was made in 1995, but I haven't seen a film like this or been made like this with this sort of drama and subtlety.
And craft
for a while.
It's the script craft. It's the performance craft.
Yes.
It's the directorial craft.
The editing craft. I mean, it comes together. It really does. And I think the choices made were thought out really well.
Mm.
So it doesn't seem like it was a movie that was just done for a quick buck or, they just put, now let's get a Stephen King movie out there. It seemed like there was a lot of thought behind this one and that all the elements did come together. So, kudos. I mean, you can't, it's very difficult to do that and to make the planets align like that in filmmaking. It's an interesting business, but this is done a really good job.
So was that a deliberate pun just then when you said the planets align, given that the highlight of this film is actually about an eclipse?
Yeah, you got me, yeah. So what about you, Greg? What are you going to give this?
Well, snap, I'm giving it an 8 as well.
Oh, wow, that's
great. Look, I'm not a fan of Stephen King horror kind of stuff, but as you just said a moment ago, if you come to this film or ignore this film because of that reason, then you've missed out.
Mm.
This is a film you probably haven't heard of. It wasn't all that well publicised.
No,
the time.
It wasn't, no.
Even though it's like, Kathy Bates, Stephen King, they're back kind of thing, even though it's a totally different kind of film. Although I actually haven't seen Misery, just so you know.
My goodness, yes.
Shut your jaw.
Yeah, I will.
But this is a striking film. And as I say, the things that came back to me over the years since I first saw it, 20-something years ago, was that visually striking section around the eclipse. Judy Parfitt's performance, it just one of those ones that just stayed with me because it's so good in both those time periods of this one character, and yet you believe that they are the same person. But this time around, second viewing, there's more that I really tuned into that I don't think I did the first time.
Mm.
It was a bit almost overwhelmed by those two elements, which is not to say that there's anything wrong with them. It's just that they were so striking. But in fact, those transitions you spoke about, the interplay between the characters and the journey of the daughter were much more with me this time around? Because it's a subtle film.
I quite honestly, I think the film is better than the book. So that's a that's
I can't
a,
comment.
Yeah, that is a look. I really enjoyed the novel, but I think there's so much more in the movie.
Because of the mother daughter.
Because of the mother daughter character or relationship, and I was moved more in the movie. But I think on this one instance, this is one case where the movie is better than the book, in my opinion. So the third film we're going to discuss is 1957's 12 Angry Men. Take it away, Greg.
The plot of 12 Angry Men is simple. A young man has been tried for his father's murder before the film starts, and now the 12 men of the jury are to decide his fate. Almost the entire film takes place on a hot and stormy night in the jury room and its adjacent bathroom. The jury is about to move swiftly to a guilty verdict until juror number 8, Henry Fonda, who is also the film's producer, reveals that he can't just leap straight to that decision. He has doubts, and as he explains these doubts and why he holds them, his argument slowly takes sway and gather momentum across the jury, with some notable holdouts. As the argument progresses and jurors begin to change their mind, it becomes clear that other agendas are informing the verdict. Whether as trivial as making it to a ball game, to deeper prejudices and experiences projected onto the case before them. None of the jurors are named, only numbered, to give the story a universality. Although this universality is undermined for a modern viewer, as the jury room distinctly lacks women and non-white people, no doubt reflecting the times. The final scene shows the 12 men reintegrating into society down the courthouse steps. They don't acknowledge each other as they go, except for Henry Fonda and another juror who are finally given names. This is ensemble acting at its finest with a stellar cast. There's a good chance you'll recognise many of the faces. In addition to Henry Fonda, there's Lee J. Cobb from On the Waterfront and The Exorcist, Martin Balsam, the stab detective from Hitchcock's Psycho, Ed Begley, who won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth 5 years later, and Jack Klugman, best remembered as TV's Coroner Quincy or Oscar Madison in The Odd Couple. And there's also long-running and well-known character actors Jack Warden, E.G. Marshall, Robert Webber, and John Fiedler, who was the original voice of Disney's Piglet. It's tempting to say that this is an actor's film, but that would be to belie the quality of the direction and black-and-white cinematography that makes the most of its enclosed space. This is the second time I've seen this film after many, many years. I wasn't previously aware that it was directed by Sidney Lumet. I've tended to hold him in poor odour as I associate him with 1974's tedious Murder on the Orient Express, a huge disappointment to this enthralled teenage fan of Agatha Christie. But Lumet's skills are fully on display here in his first feature film, keeping things moving in a tight space and a tight time frame of a little over 90 minutes. There are some powerful visual touches, such as a moment where all jury members turn their back on a juror whose prejudices have come out in full raging display, and a very compassionate ending where Fonda helps a weeping juror put his coat on when everyone else has left him behind in the jury room. It's these skills that make this film the version that people point to, and which has made it a cultural touchstone that's been referenced by many TV shows, including The Fonz when he does jury duty on Happy Days. And if you're not easily offended, you may wish to see what Inside Amy Schumer and some equally well-known comic actors did with it in 2015. But ultimately, I think it's the quality and rhythms of Reginald Rose's writing that makes this film work so well. Rose was a lawyer's son who was inspired by his experience as a juror in a manslaughter case where they argued for 8 hours. This is actually the third production of this work, preceded by a 1954 TV play and 1955 stage play. It's since been remade for TV in 1997, an audio play in 2005, each time attracting a stellar cast, and also adapted in Germany, Spain, India, Russia, and China. And there have been repeated stage revivals, including mixed gender and all-female casts. There's even a 2009 documentary about an attempt to stage it in a Beirut prison. Its power lies in its focus on what's at the heart of modern democracy and justice, that everyone is equal, and illustrates the true meaning of the presumption of innocence and reasonable doubt, and the value of empathy. It's also used as a case study in persuasion and group dynamics. That's not bad for a 96-minute film. So, Ricardo, has this film left you an angry man?
No, but it's just so brilliant.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it, and it's shot in one space.
Yeah.
But you know one thing I love about it? I'll just say, you know, you talk about the that it was a theatre, a play. Mm. A lot of films that have been a theatre play, like, you know, Denzel Washington did one a few years ago, Fences, which was based on a play. Every time I watch them, I can see that it is a play.
You made the same comment when we reviewed A Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, there we go. Exactly the same sort of a problem that I have with them. But this is just not that. The quality of the filmmaking here is some of the best I've seen for a while. It's actually quite a perfect film and perfectly directed. It just comes together so well. But it's not too preachy. All of the characters have their own prejudices and they all come to the fore.
Yep. You know, and their own arc.
And they're all challenged, you know, and then they're shut down and then it brings up another person's prejudice and whatnot. And so...
Except the Henry Fonda character.
Except, well, he's the voice of reason in the whole thing. And so he starts...
Well, it's interesting you say that he's the voice of reason because that, in fact, is what E.G. Marshall's character thinks he is. You know, it's all very logical and reasonable to him.
It is.
Until Henry Fonda does two really powerful things. He brings empathy into it, as I said earlier,
such empathy.
By saying about the glasses on the bridge of one of the witnesses' nose, which E.G. Marshall's character can then relate to because that's exactly what he has. Fonda makes him realise that's his experience.
Well, before that, before you get that revelation, and I love the way it did this because at the very beginning when, you know, he really is the only one who says not guilty, and that's where it all starts.
And he doesn't say that he believes he's not guilty. He says, I have doubt.
You know, we're talking about somebody's life here. Let's not just throw this away. And, you know, one of the beautiful parts of it, because it was only afterwards, because you start watching it, but you see this shot of, and it lingers on the defendant, the kid, looking very scared and not knowing what's going to happen. And it just lingers on him for quite a long time before it slowly dissolves into the jurors' room.
Before that, you see the judge who looks bored.
Yes, like, yes.
Just another
case. That's right, just another case. So that's right.
You get these two character shots who are incidental in the actual film.
Mm.
And you learn a lot just from those two little bits.
And then you've got the slow tracking shot of the jurors, of the 12 angry men who are about to end, which is just showing them as just everyman.
Yep.
You know, and that's what they are, just everyman. And that's the beauty of the end as well, because they've just had, and what you are witness to as an observer during this is a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this one case, and they all just go and that's it. There's that moment in there.
And when they go back out onto the street, and they're from different classes.
That's right.
But at least when they go on the street, there are a couple of women walking past. So it's kind of not just this male bastion kind of world. They're going back out into the real world.
Mm.
Speaking of the camera shots, when the film ends in the jury room and Henry Fonda is helping Lee J. Cobb put his coat back on,
beautiful moment.
There's a shot taken from the back of the closet into the room.
Mm-hmm.
Did they use that shot at the start? Because otherwise it was quite remarkable that was the first time you really were in that back part of the room looking out into the full room.
I don't think so. What really struck me during it is that the camera was always on above eye level. So you were an observer in that moment, you know, and especially the beginning and whatnot.
I think it actually descends as the film progresses.
It does, and gets closer on people.
Yes.
So that just shows up their own...
Well, it makes more about individuals rather than
their own emotion,
kind of stuff.
And when they always do the vote, you know, and you always find that somebody is... change their mind.
Yeah.
But one of the last ones, when they just used the hands up in the air, everyone's putting their hands up in the air, was just another great moment. You know, Henry Fonda to me is a revelation in this.
Really?
I've seen Once Upon a Time in the West a lot, which is a Sergio Leone Western.
Mm.
He is evil in it.
Oh.
And he's a bad guy. He's a really bad guy. So watching him in this where he's just, you know, has such empathy and heart. And he always says it during the whole film. He says, I may have got this wrong. And this is how the film is so clever. So clever because during the film, you yourself, it takes you out of thinking, oh, is he guilty or is he not? And even when E.G. Marshall, when he says toward the end, he says the reason why he thinks that the kid's guilty, suddenly you start thinking, well, yeah, you're right. Maybe he is.
But, that, know, but the, then it the takes films, you the out. Film's art is that you never actually know.
You don't know.
They don't have that kind of Hollywood ending of, no. Oh, he was actually guilty, shock,
not
or,
at all.
Oh, they got it right.
No, and it's not about that. It was about what is better. They may have let a murderer free, but is that worse than actually letting an innocent man die?
Mm.
There's a real question there.
But it's interesting how you view Henry Fonda, because this part is actually more typical of his general persona.
Yes.
He's usually a really nice, decent guy. Or have you ever seen The Lady Eve, that Preston no. Sturges screwball comedy?
No.
Where he's an innocent abroad. I haven't seen the film you're talking about. I haven't seen that, so I haven't seen him do evil. It makes perfect sense that he, not only because he's the producer of the film, and apparently he never produced again. There's something about the experience he did not like. But he is absolutely the actor to cast for this part. More than Jimmy Stewart, more than, you know, a romantic lead like Cary Grant or someone. He's the decent, intelligent guy.
Well, I must say that the studio for Once Upon a Time in the West didn't feel like Henry Fonda was the right person for that role because of his persona in other movies. But it just so happens that it was one of the first movies I saw him in.
Yeah.
Was Once Upon a Time in the West. So that's the reason, I think. But geez, he's wonderful in this. But everybody is.
Yes.
And I love everybody's story. But the room, as it's getting darker and darker,
As the storm
is coming in.
Yeah.
And you're getting Lee J. Cobb's character trying to explain the knife. Mm. And everybody's thinking he's not going to stab him because they've got such tension between the two.
Mm.
What a moment. It's quite wonderful.
But there are moments throughout.
Oh.
Like there's the moment when Henry Fonda, when they've been told this knife is very unusual, just suddenly throws one down on the table.
It's a bit
melodramatic, but it works.
It is melodramatic, but that's the thing is, what the camera just goes in. It reminded me a bit of Hitchcock, you know, the way he pulled it out, and it was like this revelation thing of the knife there. And I was like, whoa, okay.
And when E.G. Marshall's stockbroker is the second last person to shift, I found that quite emotional, that here's this guy, and he's you know meant to be the reason logic kind of guy, who only sees it one way.
Yep.
And when Henry Fonda does the thing about the empathy, and then he does, well, let's role play how this could have worked.
That's right.
In the room with the floor plan and so on, and he actually persuades different people in different ways.
He does.
Logic is his main tactic.
Yes.
But as I say, he uses empathy in other things. But when he recognizes that Marshall's character is the guy of logic, and he takes him through it in a logic with the empathy thing, which is very, very clever.
Yes.
And when that guy finally shifts because he sees that what he thought was logical actually isn't necessarily, I found that very moving.
But Lee J. Cobb's character, going back to him, his backstory with his son, having issues with his son, that really what you were seeing was a battle with his son.
It's a playing out of his domestic drama.
Absolutely. And I think Henry Fonda knows that, and he's not really willing to let somebody die, you know, on the basis of somebody's own personal dramas.
Mm.
I found that quite an emotional moment when he says not guilty at the end, when he sees his son's, he rips up the photo and just breaks down and says, not guilty. You just know he's not arguing about this case. He's having his own domestic issues with his son, and it's that's a powerful motive in itself,
and a powerful moment. Yeah,
yeah, powerful moment.
You know, the original filming of this, which was a teleplay, it won 3 Emmy Awards. Mm. It won for the direction, it won for the writing, and it won for Robert Cummings in the lead role. Now, haven't seen this, but again, Robert Cummings would be like a decent guy. I think he'd be a lot more smiley and so on. I think I can't compare them because I haven't seen both performances, but I just think Fonda is the epitome of this character. What's also interesting about the original teleplay is that two of the faces in this film, which were not familiar to me, were playing the same characters that they did in the teleplay, which I imagine is why they were cast. And that was the old guy who first supports Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
And it was also...
I really liked his character.
Yes. You know. And it was also... He was juror 9, I think. He sat next to number 8. And it was also juror 11. So Joseph Sweeney played the old guy. And then George Voskovec, I think it is, was juror 11, who was, I think, was he a watchmaker who had been in Nazi Europe?
Yes.
So he came through as well. So all the other quite well-known faces at that time playing the other roles were brought in for the movie, but at least two of the three, who I don't particularly know, what I don't know beyond this film, had been so right for those parts, they just kept that transition going.
Wow. And the ad exec.
Oh, he's great. That's Robert Ritter.
He's fantastic. He's very good.
Run up the flagpole and see who salutes kind of guy.
That's right, yes.
And absolutely. You realise he actually has no moral centre.
No.
He just is.
And will go either way. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know.
To him, it's a focus group.
Yes, yeah.
Which is not what this is really about.
No, not at all.
This was actually Oscar nominated for Best Picture, Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay, but it lost all of those to The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, you know what? I've never seen that.
Neither have I. So I can't compare them.
Yeah.
And I think it's a bit unfortunate because that is supposed to be, you know, quite a marvellous film, but this is just such a great, decent, solid, believable human drama that has just lasted over the years.
This has not dated.
No. I think black and white helps that a bit, actually.
Yeah, it does. But I think the performances are so real. And at the time, you got a lot of overacting in a lot of those 50s sort of films. Yeah. You know, there was not really... I think with Kubrick films, you know, he had in Lolita and those ones of the time, really naturalistic acting in those in his films.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you get a lot of acting in those ones, which is like, how are you? You're coming over here? You know, really sort of overacting sort of theatrical performances. But all of these characters are believable.
Yeah, you can pretty much guess where they come from. Sometimes you're told. But, like, you know, Henry Fonda is an architect, or E.G. Marshall is a stockbroker, and I think the guy from Nazi Europe was a watchmaker or a jeweler or something. And certainly the Robert Webber character is an ad man marketing kind of guy. So some you're told, but you can kind of work out what you imagine the others are in their work lives and where they come from because the writing and the acting are so good.
But it's quite amazing that they're all, but Henry Fonda, but all very quick to say guilty. She saw the murder, done, you know, black and white, this is finished. We know the type of kid this person is.
Yeah, it's all very glib analysis.
Yeah, whereas when Henry Fonda just says, hang on a minute, you don't know where he's come from. Look at his past. Look at where this kid has come from. And you're about to just commit him to the chair. No one can question it or let's have any doubt about it.
Henry Fonda's character is a bit Sherlock Holmes. Where I assume he must have been right next to the witness box because he observed details about the witnesses.
Yeah.
You know, the vanity of not wearing glasses, the pinch marks on the nose,
yes.
The look in someone's eyes. He comments on all that and he thinks through the ramifications of that and he thinks through the ramifications of the actual evidence, like the map and the train going past and brings real life understanding into it about the trains and what you can and can't see and hear. He reminded me a bit of Sherlock Holmes.
When this ended, the whole movie ended, I just thought, wow.
So what are you giving it?
10 out of 10.
Yeah, ditto.
Yeah. It's got to be. It's
a masterclass.
It really is a masterclass in everything.
As entertainment, you know, like a movie, absolutely. As a thing that makes you think about what such core concepts as presumption of innocence, reasonable doubt, and so on actually mean, it really illustrates that well. And as I said in my kind of intro, this film is used in management education and so on to look at things like persuasion, group dynamics, and so on. There's just so much meat into this.
It's probably one of the best courtroom dramas that's not set in the courtroom. It's so well made. It's so well written, so well performed, so well directed.
So why do you think you've never seen this before?
I don't know.
But Michael has been telling you for years.
He's been telling, yes, he has, you know. One of the original requests was, you know, do 12 Angry Men. Well, thank you. I don't know why I hadn't seen this.
Would you like to apologise?
No, not at all. But I haven't seen The Bridge on the River Kwai either. So apparently that is a classic as well of David Lean. So I've seen a lot of David Lean, but not that one.
Well, let's check with Michael.
Yeah. So that concludes episode 6 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Where we've had Ricardo in the confessional.
That's right.
And next time it's my turn.
It's Greg in the confessional. So next episode, we're going to do the next three films, which is 1990's Pretty Woman.
Which I've never seen.
Amazingly. Then we're going to do the 1946 film Great Expectations, where Greg has read the book
but never seen the film.
Yeah. And then we're going to do 1976 Rocky,
which I've never seen, and because I'm not a huge fan of Sylvester Stallone, as we discovered a while ago with Cliffhanger.
Let's not go there.
Well, we're going to have to go there time. We want you to go there.
We're going to be doing this again. Yep. Having the same argument again.
What if I like
most
it?
Likely. Oh, I hope you do.
Yeah, that's such an exciting
best
prospect.
Best Picture winner.
Yeah, and look at how many films have won Best Picture that are forgotten.
Yeah, but how many are great? I mean, they're never bad films, though.
Well, the only way to answer that is to come back next time.
Enjoy.
Thank you, and it's so good to be back.